issues. Is that as far as the bottom right side of the text, but I'll just go back a little bit to review what we were dealing with here, because all of this is going in a direction. Remember, when the Talmud is interested in an issue, very frequently we will use the minutiae of logic to examine a variety of hypotheses based on where you go with the logic. It may, you can get lost in wherever you're going, but it's usually going somewhere really that is even beyond that. So I want to just have a sense of the general way in which the argument is going, so that eventually we'll see what the main subject is that we're talking about. And it's not going to come through immediately. Remember, we had a baraita. And this baraita said, and a baraita has legal significance to it, a baraita dates from the time of the Mishnah, from the year 200. The baraita says, Tanu Rabbanan, this is 5b2 on the bottom right side. Tanu Rabbanan, Ketzad B'Kesef. How do we perform the act of Kesef? Okay? How do we perform, because we know that there are three ways to betroth a woman. One of them is Kesef, money, or Shavet Kesef, something that is equivalent to money. So then we want to see, how do you actually do it? What happens? What happens? And so it articulates for us, as a baraita will, what the nature of this tradition is. Ketzad b'kesef, how do you do it? Natan la kesef o shavet kesef, if he gives her money or something equivalent to money, v'amar la, and he says to her, a declaration. Now, there are, first of all, two very important parts to this. One is that there is a transfer of something of value. We saw that in the Mishnah to begin with. And the transfer is crucial. There has to be the transfer of something from the hand of the groom to the bride. We will see that. So far, we can imagine maybe it's just transfer in general. It could be from the bride to the groom to the bride. But the way this is articulated, it's from the groom to the bride. And he has to say something. Okay? So there are two aspects to it. There is a declaration, there's an activity, and a declaration. And it would appear that you need both. It would appear from the baraita, but of course, as these things go, we may not end up there. That's where we're starting out. But you need both of them. So, Vamala, and you have a variety. Interestingly enough, there are a variety of formulas that you can use. I might have thought that there was just one formula. We just use one formula in our modern wedding ceremony. But here there's a variety of possibilities and declarations that you can make. Here's Areya Mikodeshetli. That happens to be what we use in a modern ceremony. We use those words, Areya Mikodeshetli, but we actually add to them. We say, Vitaba'atzo, with this ring, Kedat Moshe Yisrael, according to the law of Moses in Israel. You haven't seen that here. That's what we do. Or Hareya Ma'oresetli. That's another way of making the same point using biblical rather than rabbinic language. And we said a little bit about that last time, that in the Bible, the word used for the Kiddushin is not Kiddushin, but Erusin. Eros, translated usually as betrothed, is the word that you will find in the Bible. You will not find the term lekadesh. You won't find anything like that referring to the same state of affairs where you have entered into this first part of marriage. Okay? And then we've got a two-stage marriage ceremony here. So you can say harei at ma'oresetli, harei at lil into. Behold, you are have become my wife. Right? Arezo Mekodeshet, this is Mekodeshet. The woman is in fact married as a result of that. Again, the terminology is difficult. I don't know what to say when I translate these things because there's no translation for them. Mekodeshet doesn't mean married. So you use betrothed. The only problem with that is it doesn't mean betrothed. So it won't mean one and it won't mean the other. What it means is that first stage of marriage, which we've defined how many times. Okay? Aval hi shenatna v'amra hi. But if she gives, and she says, Hareini mikudeshet lacha, I am mikudeshet betrothed to you, Hareini me'oreset lacha, right, she turns it around. Hareini lacha le'imtu, behold, I am your wife, eina mikudeshet. She is not mikudeshet. Okay? Now, the modern reader, of course, reads this and immediately has a framework for responding to it. Obvious to us when we read it, but the issue here is male-female. Male has power, female does not have power. Okay? I shall try to prove to you that it's totally irrelevant, but that, of course, is the way we would assume that that must be what it's talking about, because we're modern readers. Okay, but that is the brayta. That's the end of the brayta. What goes on from here is that the Gemara, in its own characteristic fashion, we'll start doing an analysis of it, of the Baraita. The analysis of the Baraita is, the Rav Papa says in a Matkis, is to really set up a problem to show that there's an essential problem with the Baraita. Now, there may or there may not be a problem with the Baraita. You'll only see in the course of time. So what he does, he takes the two parts of the Baraita, the two independent parts. He says, if you follow each part separately, you take the next logical step, which appears to be logical. It may not be extremely logical, but it appears to be at least reasonably logical. You will end up with a problem. Namely, the first part of the Baraita will contradict the second part of the Baraita. That's fine. He says, Tana Danatan Hu Viamar Hu. Okay? She's Mikudeshet. If he has given, and he has taken, and he has said. Right? If we change one of those, and arbitrarily, he just wants to be consistent, because it'd be consistent in both parts of the Baraita, he says, Hanatan Hu. If he gives, and she says, right? Take one of those and change it. Take one of those and change it. We're going to keep him giving, but she says, so it's who Natan, I said, Natan who? He gave, Yamra he. And she says. Alright? So since we learned if he gives and he says she's Mikudeshet, the implication is if you change one of those, ain't a Mikudeshet. It wouldn't be working. Because it's as if you need two things to happen. He has to give, he has to say. Change one of those? Arbitrary, you could change either of them, but you'll see that in his argument he wants to change just one, the same one in both cases. So he's going to change the second one, namely, because he gives and she says. Well, what would that do? It would change the conclusion, make it the opposite conclusion. The first conclusion was he gives, she says, he gives, he says, Mikudeshet. Change one of those, and what's the logical conclusion? Ain't a Mikudeshet. She's not the throne. That doesn't make sense. Okay? Change one of them, since it says he has to give. He has to say. If we change one of those, then it would change the conclusion. Huh? So that's fine. You with me so far. That's reasonable. Anatanhu, the Amrahi, he gives, she says, in a mikodeshi. So cut that picture now. We derived it from the first part of the Baraita, seen as fairly logical, and we came to the conclusion that Eina Mikudeshet, she is not Mikudeshet, if she is the one who says. Now we'll take the second part of the Baraita. Remember, the second part of the Baraita is, she gives, she says. The conclusion was Eina Mikudeshet. She's not Mikudeshet. Okay? So, going the same way. Change one part of it. And one part of it. And what happened? Then she's Mikudeshet. Okay? Yeah. Okay, we changed one part, so we changed the conclusion. Right? So now she's Mikudeshet. So it's the same picture, though. In the second part of the Baraita, what we have changed is we've changed the first piece. Namely, we made Hunatan. Vatanhu.
Hige.
And the second part is Amrahi. She said. Of course, when we changed the first part of the Brisa, we did exactly the same thing. We said Natanhu to Amrahi. He gave, she said. But now we've come to two opposite conclusions. Because in the first part of the Brisa, the result of this kind of logic was that Eina Mekodeshet. She's not Mekodeshet. The second part of the Brisa, we have exactly the same scenario. And it brings us to exactly the opposite conclusion. Alright? So, therefore, there must be either a problem with the Brisa, or there's something wrong. Huh? Or he's got to explain it another way. Okay.
Oh, it's just an exercise.
Well, but we've got to see where he's going to go with it. Right? He's shown us, because there could be a lot of ways to solve this problem. That he's created a problem which now we have to solve. That's the force of this. It could be. You could answer all kinds of things. You could say, well, there's a third, but we forgot something. Then we had the argument, there was actually a third piece to it, but they forgot it in the Brisa. There's got to be something that solves this problem. Okay. So the Gemara now will make a suggestion. Reshidavka. The first part of the Brisa is really what the rabbis wanted to teach. That was the real issue that they wanted to teach. And sometimes when they get involved in doing that, it's for the sake of symmetry. Symmetry. You know, some of you are teachers. Sometimes you want to make a point. You make that point, and then as a result of making that point, you've sort of built the whole thing, and you follow the whole thing through, but you really hope the students don't pay attention to all the implications of the last thing you said. Because it looks really nice, but when it gets down to it, you wouldn't want to publish it. It's good, it's almost good, but it's not really good, okay? So, that's the case. The first part was really what they were trying to teach, but for the sake of symmetry, and they made it nice, and it's a pretty argument, and that's the way the Baraka is, the second part, forget about the second part. I didn't mean it. Gilda Radner used to say? We don't know it at all. We're saying this is one possible way to solve the problem.
Never.
We don't know that
never
this is the...
Never.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, your mind is not here. I mean, this
no, that's what
it
is.
This is
a Talmud. The Talmud says once in a while, the Talmud says, never mind. Never mind. The Gilda Radner kind of solution. Okay?
I mean, so, what he could have done is what I mentioned to you earlier. He could have said, she gave, he said, and then it would be perfectly logical, and then suddenly it becomes acceptable.
Because you want it to be acceptable. They don't necessarily want it to be acceptable. They want to go somewhere with it, and maybe we'll find out the right answer. Maybe we won't find out the right answer. The Talmud is having a good time. So the first possibility is, never mind. But of course, as soon as you say never mind, the Gemara doesn't like an answer like that. What do you mean, never mind? This is the Talmud. This is the law. You can't say never mind. That's what it says next. The Tani said, for Milta de Santa Valeratio, you think even in a situation which is maybe not so exactly well constructed, they would actually leave it alone so that the end contradicts the beginning? Come on. This is Talmud. Talmud doesn't allow you to do things like that. But that's what it says. The Talmud answers your answer. Okay? Right, so that's what it says next. And that objection stands. That's correct. Basically, the Talmud doesn't like to find itself put in the position of not really being too logical. And the Talmud doesn't like that. So the objection, in fact, is sustained. So it offers now another possibility, because, in fact, the problem that was raised is an interesting problem. And first effort to solve it by saying, never mind, that's not a good way to solve it. So it goes on to say, Ela Hachikama. Now, this is really what it means. Natanhu va'amarhu, he gave and he said, Peshita da'avu kedushin, everybody knows that that's a kosher kedushin. That's simple. That's simple. Okay? Natanhu v'amrahim. if he gave and she sinned, nasi kamishi natnahi v'yamrahi, then if that's the case, it is like nasa kami, it has turned now into a situation like where she natnahi, where she gave and she sinned. But if you change one of those things in the first part, then it affects the second part. Right? And it's as if it doesn't work. It's just like a woman doing it over there. Right? So if he changes one thing in the first part, it's like she were doing both of them in the second. It's equivalent of the second part. Exactly. That's just as bad. Just as bad. Below Havu Kiddushin. Now, that's not such a good answer. That's not such a good answer, because in effect that's allowing still, it's sort of rewriting the text. Well, I guess you could do that, you know, or we don't know what the Baraita originally said, but maybe the Baraita isn't written very carefully. That's sort of the implications of this type of solution. So the Gemara, it brings another possibility, because the Gemara, when it brings two possibilities, as it is going to now, it's uncomfortable with the first possibility. Or soon it's now, this is actually the second possibility. This is still not smooth. Not smooth. So now there's another possibility. Natan hu, the Amar hu, if he gave, and he said, the Mikudashis. That's easy. That we know. Natnahi v'amrahi ena mekudeshet. If she gave and she said, not mekudeshet, then there's no marriage. Natan hu v'amrahi. If he gave and she said, sveikara hi v'chashina narabanan. Then we are now set into a doubtful situation. And it may be rabbinically that the rabbis have to treat it as if it's a maybe marriage. Okay? So in other words, what the conclusion of the Gemara is here...
I don't have a maybe marriage.
I'll tell you in a minute. The Gemara... in order to keep the integrity of the Baraita, and it's important, Baraita are assumed to have integrity. And that doesn't mean they do have integrity. They're assumed to have integrity. And if there seems to be some sort of a problem, then it's nearly always worked out, not always, but it's nearly always worked out in some way that's reasonably satisfying. And this is not so reasonably satisfying, because the conclusion here is, if instead of changing both terms, you change one of them, in fact, it's not either mekudeshet or not mekudeshet, but somewhere in between the two of them. That, frankly, is not such a bad idea. Only problem with it is, what do you mean? What does it mean to say you're in between? What does it mean to say you're in between? Okay? That would be the problem. But I have a solution for that. I know what that means. What it means is that from a rabbinic, from the perspective of the rabbis, not from the perspective of the Torah, not from God's perspective, but just from the perspective of the law as it has developed in terms of our sources. And here is a classic source of Baraita. In fact, we're left in a quandary, and we don't truly know the answer if we change one of the two necessary parts. We really are in a quandary. We're not in a quandary that we've violated the law of the Torah. That we know we're not in. But the rabbis don't know what to do with it, because their law is just uncertain. So in effect, what they do is that they bring to the situation all the stringencies of every possibility. Okay? The stringencies of every possibility. Such as, if a woman were in this position, okay, and this happens on Monday, and she's put in this position, and we don't know whether she's married or not. On Thursday, she gets married to another guy. Okay? What do we do now? this is possible. It may not happen every day, but, you know, we've run into a difficult situation. So we have to find some real life, some set of facts, where, in fact, we could have the stringencies of both situations. And here I've just described one to you. On Monday, she's in this doubtful wedding arrangement. She decides she has enough of this guy. I decided, I heard one the other day. Some Hollywood star got married on Monday. It lasted until Wednesday. And, what? They weren't really married?
No, it wasn't
legal. Oh, wasn't legal. I don't pay. I don't listen to all the details.
He said that she...
Oh, I said... Well, it was a doubtful one. So it wasn't so bad, but if on Thursday now, the same thing would happen again with another guy, he got a problem. And in fact, there had been a conclusion, as far as the law goes, I can't tell you whether there ever was a case, or whether there were 10,000 such cases, or whether only in the year 4,500 there will be one case like this. But the reality is that the way you have to deal with that is that both women have, both in both those cases, the guy has to give the woman a gift. That's the bottom line, right? Because we have to deal with both of them as possible marriages. And in both cases, if the first case was a marriage, then she shouldn't have married the second guy, right? If she was married to the first guy, she got married to a guy on Monday, and that was a real marriage, she couldn't marry the guy on Thursday, okay? If she marries the guy on Thursday, what was she doing with the guy on Monday? Okay? So we solved that problem by forcing both those guys to give this one lady a gift. Okay? So Francis, you said, how could it ever be? I just told you how it could be. I'm not telling you that this is frequent. I never had one all the years of my rabbinate. But probably somebody did. You know, if you live long enough, nearly everything happens. Nearly every possibility that you can imagine. I was once a student of a rabbi, a great rabbi. He said, you know, one of the things that's amazing, he was then about 75 years old, he said to me, you know, this week, things happened to me that never happened to me before. He said, when I was 50, I never thought that would happen when I was 75. It was a nice thing for him to say. You know, life is full of surprises. And there's always something that's going to happen tomorrow that, as smart as you are, as much as you've figured it out, and you know all the possibilities, tomorrow the thing is going to happen that you never thought of before. Not only that you never thought, but nobody ever thought of before. It's going to be a surprise to everybody. Okay? So that's where we are here. Okay? Now, having come that far, I think one of the things that we certainly have learned is that there seems to be an obligatory pattern in the making of the marriage. It requires him to give and him to say. So we're still left wondering exactly why that is. Whether that always has to be, and if it does always have to be, what's the justification for it? Okay, so let me go on now. Now we're on 5b3, bottom right hand paragraph. Shmuel, Amar Shmuel, Bekidushin Natan La Keses Dishavek Keses. Right, in Kiddushin. He gave her money, Vishabha Kesef, or something equivalent to money. Ve'amala, and he said to her, Hare at mekodeshet. Right, that just can, to some extent, repeat the Baraita. What? No, 5b4. Amala hare at mekodeshet. We're still down the bottom of 5B. Bottom of 5B. Are you at the top of 5B or the bottom of 5B? Okay. Right? So he gave, and he said, another possible formula here. Harayat mukodeshet. Harayat me'areset. Harayat le'intu. Now Shmuel, realize, is later than the Baraita, but earlier than Rav Papa. Rav Papa is a late Amora. Shmuel is in the first generation of Amoraim, right after the time of the Baraita. As the Baraitot are dated no later than 200 CE. Shmuel is about 225. Okay, so we're doing right after that. So Shmuel, it seems to be that the Babylonian rabbis now have a tradition which very much reflects the Baraita, which predates them. Hareat me'areset, hareat le'intu, hare zo mekudeshet. Okay? So he says all of those things, and the woman is mekudeshet. Now look what follows. Hareini ishech. I am your husband. Hareini barlech. I am your husband. Hareini arusayach. I am your betrothed, your arus. Ein kan beit michush means there is no room for doubt. Namely, there's no question about the fact, Ein ha mekudeshet. He goes on. Vechein begerushin. Similarly, in the laws of divorce. Natan mava amala, he gave to her a get, and he says to her, either says verbally or written in the get, Hareat mishulachat, you are sent away. Hareat migoreshet, you are divorced. Hareat muteret lechol adam, you are permitted to any man. Hare zo migoreshet, this woman is divorced. But he says the following, Eini ishech, I am not your husband. Eini valech, I am not your husband. Eini arusech, I am not your arus. Ein kan beit nechush, there's no doubt about the fact. Why? And she's not the first. She's not the first. The opposite of the first stuff there. Let's forget about the divorce part, and then let's look at the first part, which is the mekudeshet part, or ein mekudeshet. Okay? Now the startling thing here is, Natan hu, v'amar hu. Yeah. Right? He gave and he said. You already had decided before we read this that the issue was that he has to do everything. Guess what? That's not right.
We have to do it right.
Well, whatever it is, there's a formulation here that's permissible, there's a formulation that's not permissible. And we're going to have to figure out what's the difference between the permissible and the impermissible formulation. So it's not a matter only of who says it, but what is said. The language itself is crucial. You see, if he says to her in the form, Areat Mekudeshet, you are Mekudeshet to me, you are Mereset to me, you are wife to me, then that's okay. Okay? But if he says, I am your husband, that's not okay. What's the difference between those two statements?
You're right on it.
Good. In the first statement, he says, "You are my." In the second set of statements, he says, "I am your." Right? "I am your" statements are not permissible statements. "You are my" statements are permissible statements.
He did the kniyah.
What?
He did the kniyah.
You're moving in the direction. Right? You already are sensing where we're going here. All right. The ear already has the sense here that what we're witnessing is an active form of change of status. where he, in fact, invokes that change of status by a declaration, and, of course, by an action as well. Okay? And if it is simply a statement that reflects on his change of status, that's not permissible. That's not permissible.
In one area, in other words, one, they're both sort of actively involved. The second one, it's sort of a passive statement.
It's sort of a passive statement, and it focuses on him and not on her.
It doesn't require her approval.
It doesn't require her approval as well. Correct. 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 All of that is correct. All of that is correct. Now, just as an aside, so the key thing I want you to remember here is that while we started out assuming that anything that he should do it and he should say it, that it would work, it's not true. It's not a question of who does it. There's something else operating here. It even matters what's said by him, assuming that he gives and he says. He's got to say the right thing. And the formulation of that has got to be directed toward her and not toward a statement about who he is. Okay? Now, again, as modern readers, what we bring to this is that we're trying to figure out what the philosophical issue is that is being hidden here. The assumption is that there's a philosophical issue. There may be, but that's not the way the Talmud would think about the question. Talmud would really think about the question in terms of what does it say in the Torah? You remember that we explored first why it is that even kesef is used. And we saw that in the very first page of the Talmud that we studied. Kesef is used because there are verses in the Torah that in fact say kesef. Or at least that if you put two verses together, they say kesef. Right? You remember the key phrase? Ki yikach ish isha. If, when a man shall take a woman for a wife. Right? When a man shall take a woman for a wife. Right? He has to take her for a wife. The very activity then must be responsive to the biblical verse. Similarly, you will see in the second part of the Baraita, where we're dealing with a divorce. It's exactly the same thing. He has to have the active party in the statement and cannot just reflect on the fact that there's a divorce. He can't be the party in the statement. He has to say something about her in the statement. He can't say it about himself, he has to say it about her. Why? Because, similarly, the Torah sets things up. The language of the Torah forces the issue. It says, V'chatav la sefer kritut, he shall write for her a book of divorcement. It doesn't say she shall write for him, it says he shall write for her. The development of the law is forced by the structure of the biblical verses. Whether there is then a philosophy behind that will be maybe for reflection. But really what is forcing the issue is the Bible. The Bible is forcing the issue. And it is the way things are stated in the Bible that creates the permissible and the non-permissible. Okay? Questions for here.
What is the, speaking about him, what is the point of him giving if he does not follow up with saying or intends to say?
He has to. He has to give and he has to say. So and he has to say the right thing as well.
So he has no point in him giving and her saying, because once he gives, he's committed to either say right away or later on.
Correct. Unless we might, in theory, because what we'll ask, and I told them I was going to ask at a later stage of the game, well, why even the saying? What's the purpose of saying? You can imagine what the purpose of saying is probably going to be, and I won't broach that yet, but then the Talmud will say, well, is that the only way to make get that message across? Because you might say, so there are a variety of ways to do it, and in fact, if you look at the biblical verse is ki kach ish isha. when a man shall take a woman as a wife, does it say anything about saying anything? It doesn't really say anything about saying anything. So the fact that there is a subject of saying, that there is a verbal articulation that goes together with the action, is not forced by the verse. Okay? There must be another reason for that. I won't answer it now, but there must be another reason.
Well, the other verse was the purchasing of the
land. That's it.
The
Ephron Achiti by Abraham from Ephron Achiti.
Right. So there it's a purchase. Somebody's acquiring something.
Correct.
If you're going to stay parallel to that formulation, you have to have a purchaser who purchases something.
But what does the purchase involve?
Exchange
of the money. Now the next question is, do you have to say something when you purchase with money?
Well, in that case, Abraham went to great lengths to have everybody within earshot hear exactly the way this transaction was occurring.
Mm-hmm.
There were many witnesses that there were people in that.
Could be. You're right. Could be. That's a general issue that will happen a lot. Let's say when you go to Dwayne Reed, you pay your money. Do you have to say, with this money, I thee pay?
Well, we Dwayne Reed, and this is probably a much more oral and verbal society.
All
of
the time. You're right.
But
where we're going with this is that the verbal piece of it has to do with the public nature of the thing that's going on and the demonstration to all the parties concerned that this particular activity, which could be misinterpreted, it could be misinterpreted, and we'll see a variety of ways that you could misinterpret it, should not be misinterpreted. Okay? That's exactly right. He says you could give a woman money. You could give her a ring, let's say. That's not the money. We could go, I don't like where we could go with that. We give her a ring. Because you give a woman a ring, that means you're married to her?
No.
That could be a problem. I can imagine that could be a real problem. Okay? You could just want to give her a gift. So how do we know which is which? Well, already you can sense how we're going to know which is which. Got to be some ways to demonstrate this in the public in a very clear way. So that's part of it. Part of it will be forced by the nature of what the Bible itself says and the way it's formulated in the Torah. Okay?
The divorce is different, though. You can tell a divorce and regardless of what you say afterwards, everything is contained in that bill of divorce.
But what is contained in that bill of divorce that happens to be, as a matter of fact, exactly what's here in the Talmud.
Yeah, so what difference does it make if in addition he says it?
Oh, it doesn't make sense, because I don't know what says me.
What?
If you read a contract and I say, this contract says, does that mean it's saying it out loud? The very phrase, it says and he says, I don't really know what that means. I don't know what it means verbally he's saying it. Or because if we're dealing with something that is written, and now we're dealing with Kesef, and if Kesef is not written. So I know that when you give Kesef, you've got to say something. But we know there are three forms of Kiddushin. How about the second form, which is a shtar? Do you have to say something when you give a shtar? Or, in fact, what is what we are saying, that you have to write in that document language which clearly states the fact that this document is given for the sake of Kiddushin. Right? Both of those are possible, and we're going to deal with it when and if we get to that particular place. But the point is so far that says doesn't necessarily mean speak. Just depends on the
written. They don't have to be in the same spot.
Correct. It depends on the specifics.
But it has to be an acceptable declaration by the other people.
Correct. Well, we already saw that in the very beginning, that the woman has to be willing to accept it. Right? So, indeed, that also helps her know what the nature of this gift is. because she has to be willing to accept it on those terms. Right? She might be perfectly happy to accept a gift, but not to be married to the guy.
Oh.
That's not hard to imagine. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, so Shmuel says, behold, you are betrothed. Hare at mekudeshet. Remember that this phrase of Shmuel, Hare at mekudeshet, is a little bit different than the way the Baraita said it. Is it? Let me see. Yes, I think it is. Where is the Baraita, original Baraita? See if I can find the language. Yes, look at the original Baraita on 5b2 at the bottom. Says, Hare at mekudeshet li. Hare at me'oreset li. You are mekudeshet to me, or you are me'oreset to me. Aren't you checking on her? So, the phrase is mekudeshet li. Mekudeshet li. Me'oreset li. You are betrothed to me. Look at Shmuel's statement. Shmuel's statement is Amar Shmuel, this is 5b4. Hare at mekudeshet. Not hare at mekudeshet li, hare at mekudeshet. Hare at me'oreset. You are me'oreset. Not me'oreset li, but me'oreset. It's a problem. There's a word missing. Which is the word that's missing?
Li.
So li means to me. That's a key word. It's a key word. If a guy is giving a woman the ring or whatever in a tesis, and he says, you are betrothed with this,
to whom?
That's the end of it, right? It's precious to whom? In most transactions, you can send a shaliach. You can send an agent. Generally speaking, in the law, your agent is like you. And so this is a transaction which is a transaction of money. Most transactions of money can be done by your agent. Well, the guy says, hurry up, look at this. The lady's wondering, go home.
To
Joe. Back there. To you. To somebody else. That unnamed person. So, what seems odd here in Shmuel's formulation is that he leaves out the word li. He leaves out the word li. And it's a real problem. So the Gemara says, what?
I just thought that it was understood and that he was concentrating on the beginning.
Well, that could be. That's possible.
Which is the verb and the subject, and that part was not
certainly, important. That's certainly possible. Certainly possible. Let's see what it says. Rav Papa says to Abaye, Rav Papa, Papa's been a key figure around here. The main of the Safar Shmuel, Yadayim She'en Mochichot Havyan Yadayim. Is this to say that Shmuel takes the point of view, and this is the way it's stated, Yadayim She'en Mochichot, literally, yad? It's a hand. A yad also, even in modern Hebrew, is also a handle. Or basically now you say in modern Hebrew, yadit. Yadit is a handle. But yad can be a handle. If something has a certain attachment to it, which you pick it up by, it puts in the yadah. Okay, that's its yad. So that's actually the way it would be properly translated. Is this to say that Shmuel has the point of view that Yadayim handles She'en Mochichot, which are not absolutely evident, Havyan Yadayim are nonetheless handles? Now, this is an area of law that is in Nidarim. Nidarim. Nidarim are vows. A person makes a vow. If you make a vow, you have to keep your vow. So the question is, what if you make only half a vow?
So you can't keep up with the vow.
No, we may not know it. Let's say you say, I am not eating tomorrow. Okay? You see what I did? I went like that. Now, if you remember the conversation of 3 hours ago that you might have been a part of, if you remembered that, you would know that we were talking about tuna fish. Mm-hmm. But I didn't say anything about tuna fish. Right? Now, you're wondering, when I said, I'm not eating anything tomorrow, was I referring to something I said before, which was the tuna fish? Or was I making a general statement that I'm not eating anything tomorrow? What if I said, I'm not eating tomorrow? Oh, you assume that, but you don't know the whole story. Okay? You don't know the circumstances. Generally speaking, circumstantial evidence is crucial in knowing what people mean by what they say. Some people are very articulate. And when they say something, they always say it in a very clear way. Other people, you know people like this. Some of us are like this. Some of us may be married to people like this. We have to figure out always what your spouse means when they say what they're saying. They say yes, they mean no. You know, that can happen. You have children like this. Your children say, yes, I want to do that. When they say that, you know they mean no, they don't want to do it. But in those circumstances, they're trying to be nice to you, and therefore they say the opposite of what they mean. What do you mean? So what do they mean? They mean what they say, or they mean something else? General problem in language, and this has always been and always will be. Question is, when we are dealing with vows, if we say something that seems to indicate something that probably is the intent, is that enough? Or do we require, since we take vows so seriously, that things have to be absolutely clear when stated? And that's a general, it's a very interesting problem. I'm sure you lawyers deal with problems like this. I deal with it in my life. We all deal with it in one way or another in our lives. Okay? Now, the Talmud discusses this in Masechet Nedarim. And this, Shmuel has a point of view about this. Realize that in what we are just examining, there's also a little bit of this. In other words, Shmuel is saying, Hare ad mekodeshet. The woman is in front of him. The guy is saying, Hare ad mekodeshet. So Shmuel is saying, maybe he's saying, well, you don't always have to have complete and absolutely clear statements. Generally, the circumstances are clear enough so that we can abstract from them and know what people mean by what they say. Or maybe you'll say, that's terrible. You can't do that because you can make a lot of mistakes like that, and people can get married to people they don't expect to get married to. Even if it would be true in, let's say, the laws of vows, how can we allow it to be true in the laws of marriage? Okay, that's the problem. So, it appears, or at least one thing, it appears it's possible that Shmuel means, in fact, Hareat Mekudeshet is enough. You don't have to say the whole thing. Shmuel is of the belief that as long as you say a partial statement, it's as if the whole statement is made. That's what we're saying. The name of the Savar Shmuel, can we learn from this? It's not saying that we must learn. But Lenaimna, do we learn from this? Namely, the Shmuel statement right above. Do we learn from this? The Savar Shmuel, Yadayim She'en Mochechot, handles that are not absolutely clear. In other words, statements that are not crystal clear. Havyan Yadayim. Nonetheless, are acceptable statements. And we have to act on them, and we accept them as meaning whatever we think they mean. So we said it, Shmuel says that? The Hatanan, you might have thought that, but, we have a Mishnah, Batman, Omer, Ehei, Harei, Zen, Nazir. Right? A guy is standing there, and a guy says, Ehei, I'll be. One type of vow that the Talmud discusses is the vow of a Nazarite. You know what the vow of a Nazarite is?
Okay. Well, that was going to be really my question. There's two kinds of vows, one between people, the other between a person and God. The
right.
Nazarite vow is a person and God
right.
committing themselves to refrain from certain things for a period of time, and so on and so forth. But, so I think the word vow, the crucial thing is who the party
mm-hmm.
to a vow. And obviously, if it's between you and God, then presumably God knows what you intended. But if between you and somebody else, the need for precision is obvious to me. It needs to be addressed more directly.
Not as clear as one might think, because in the vow of the Nazarite, as I say, we have to know, the rabbis have to know, whether this fellow is a Nazarite or not, because he will be treated differently if he is than if he isn't. So in a way, even though you're right, it's between God and the Nazarite, still the way in which everybody reacts to him, there has to be some commonly understood conclusion to whether we accept this statement as a meaningful statement or not, because we have to know whether to treat him that way. If we decide that his statement is a meaningless statement, then we won't treat him as a Nazarite.
And there, there's clearly a sex difference, you know, in terms of the protection for women about their commitment to the vow and the ways in which that might be annulled.
Correct.
Different than for men.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that same sort of tradition is carried over or has an impact in terms of this wedding event.
Well, I don't know that we have to answer that either. Okay, it might or it might not, but let's see where the Talmud goes with it. Okay? Okay, not yet. The Hatnan, let's just take the case of the Nazarite. Let's see how Shmuel deals with that issue as far as the Nazarite goes. Alright? The Mishnah just said, Ha'omer Ehe, I will be. Harei ze Nazir, he becomes a Nazarite. So that seems to be what the Mishnah says. In other words, a partial statement is accepted as a meaningful statement. The Havinanva, and the Talmud debated that Mishnah. That by Havinanva, that means the Hayinuva, we argued about it. The Talmud debated that issue. The Dilma Ehe Betani Kamar, perhaps. The Talmud says, perhaps the man means when he says, I shall be in a state of fasting. Maybe that's all he meant. He just meant I'll be in a state of fasting. The Amar Shmuel, and Shmuel said in that argument about the Nazarite, the Hushaya Nazir Over Lefanav. Shmuel said, well, when the Mishnah says that the guy says, I will be, and the Mishnah concludes that he is a Nazarite, Shmuel says this is in a case where it's obvious because a Nazarite is walking right in front of him. So in other words, I will be is in itself an insufficient statement. But if there's a Nazarite standing next to the guy, and the guy says, I will be, the circumstances are clear enough, and therefore the guy is in the ultimate. So, in other words, what Shmuel was saying is, if it's obvious beyond any doubt by the circumstances, that's what the Mishnah means, that a partial statement is acceptable. That's what it means. But if it's not obvious, namely, when a guy comes in there and says to a lady, you are betrothed, not at all obvious whether it's to him or somebody else. Now, I can imagine if it's under the chuppah, the boat, and he's dressed in a tux, She's in a wedding gown. Maybe that's obvious. But that's not what they're talking about here. What they're talking about is some sort of informal statement with something that goes on. And of course, what we're worried about is what you mentioned before, the giving of a gift. How do we know that the gift, let's say this woman is dying to get married to the guy. The guy doesn't want to marry her. He just wants to give her a gift. He says to her, I want you to take this. And she takes it and she says, Mikudasha. The guy says, what are you talking about? Are you crazy? Right? Well, maybe that's right. Maybe Mikudasha. How do we know? Okay? So, that's the problem. So Shmuel is saying, and Shmuel has the point of view, if it's not really 100% obvious, as it must have been in the case of this Mishnah, where the Mishnah said, I'll be, and the standing right in front of him is a Nazarite, okay, that one will take a partial statement. But otherwise, partial statements, we don't allow partial statements. So if that's true, then we're at that to really find some in terms of Abai and of Papa. So what sense does Shmuel make then? Shmuel only has a partial statement. So on the one hand, Shmuel is telling us that partial statements are no good. On the other hand, Shmuel is telling us partial statements are good. How could that be? Gotta keep going. Okay? Rav Papa then keeps going. This is just what I said. He says, the reason why Shmuel says that if you say just, I shall be, it's enough to make the guy a Nazarite, it's because it was obvious. Halavahi, without the circumstances being so obvious, then the guy wouldn't be a Nazarite. Similarly, in the marriage case, it's not always so obvious. Haha, so we said we have a contradiction now. Shmuel isn't making sense. So the mother says, Haha, but my askin and Yamarli. Tashikamara says, what are we really talking about in Shmuel's statement? Hare atmekudeshet. He doesn't mean atmekudeshet. He means atmekudeshet li. He just left it out. Is that possible? You were taking his statement as being, you know, that he was innovating something new here and saying you don't have to say the word li. No, that's not what's meant. It just left it out of the it was just left it out. I mean, of course it has to say li. You're right. Shmuel requires a complete statement. It has to be obvious. And so it should say li. Okay?
We
might say Haraya.
We say Zahariah sometimes.
Right.
We need
Haraya. Correct. Correct. It's actually an issue for rabbis. You'll find different rabbis doing this. Some rabbis will say, I always say to the couple, I said to the guy, you have to say this formula. Hare at Mekud Veshavim B'Tabad Sokabat Moshe V'Yisrael. So I write it out for you. I said, would you like to say it on your own or would you like me to prompt you? So, in 95% of the cases, the guys say, prompt me. And it's not only, what? It's not only because they're afraid of forgetting, you know, it's a Hebrew problem. An awful lot of guys, if you ask them what their name was under the chuppah, they forget everything. They're just speechless, you know. If they can remember to breathe, it's a big accomplishment. So in that case, I've officiated the weddings of my colleagues who know exactly what to say because they sort of, and they stand there under the chuppah as dumb as the day they were born. They can't handle anything. So So the question that the rabbi, in fact, has to ask himself, and people have different policies on this, is that how much of it do you say? Do you say, when you're repeating, you say, repeat after me, Harei At. The guy says, Harei At. Mekudeshet. And then you say, Li? Because the crazy thing is that it's as if the rabbi is marrying the bride. So some will say, you know, Mekudeshet, and then or some say it, you know, it's a problem that you have coming out of this scenario like this, okay? Well, first of all, I don't remember whether I did it or the other rabbi. we had two rabbis. Remember? I don't remember how we split the ceremony.
But you haven't given them
the right. That's correct. That's why many of us take the point of view that it's okay in the circumstances, and because it's obvious that you're prompting a person who has forgotten everything.
You said repeat after me.
Correct. You said repeat after me. Correct. But there are people who won't do that, too.
Oh.
Oh, many people won't do that.
Sometimes they say leave. You may have answered this already, but I'm still hung up on a partial vow.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an interesting situation. If a guy's under the hoof and his entire life is passing before his eyes, and he really doesn't know what's happening, and he says, I swear, is that a full vow? I mean, is his swearing to those words obliging him to be responsible for that vow?
So far we don't know, to tell you the truth, because one of the things that we really don't see clearly here, we're moving in this direction now, is to what extent are the words crucial? We've seen some words are crucial, because if you say them the wrong way, you've created problems.
Or if you understand the words that are, like in a court, swear to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth, and you know.
Well,
my opinion is versus yours.
Well, that's correct. I mean, let's say you swear in a court, you know, and you we used to do this as kids, you know, you go like this. You do it, and you don't. You say it, and you don't mean what you say. Okay.
Or
you try to
understand the implications,
or you don't understand the implications. Okay. Let's say that happens to you in a court. How far will that get you in an American court?
Not very far.
Okay. I assume it won't get you very far.
No,
at all.
No, no.
Won't get you far in hardly any court of law, because the truth is that's not an excuse. But if you've gotten that far, you can't use an excuse. You can step back.
In martial law, you assume that responsibility.
Correct,
whatever.
Correct, correct. And things that are inside, the court can't take responsibility for what you're thinking. It can only take responsibility for what you're saying or what you're doing. And so what you're thinking has a different level of force to it than what you're saying and what you're doing. Saying and doing has a much greater force to it. Okay? Yes.
How do you handle when a situation where you have two rings? It would appear from the discussion here, I'm not saying that he's not, at the same time, we'd make the whole issue very clear.
Correct. In my ceremonies, for example, I don't do the two rings together. When I do a double ring ceremony, we do the Kiddushin first, then we read the Ketubah, and then I do a second ring after that, and I use completely different language. The language is Amila Dodiva Dodimi, in order not to get into any of these problems. So we separate it in time, put it in, not in the erasing part of the ceremony, but in the Kiddush, in the Chuppah part of the ceremony, in order to clearly differentiate and to make it clear that the Kinyan has taken place appropriately and properly.
You ever come up in a situation where a couple have decided to write their own exchange vows?
Yeah. See, that's fine.
That.
Put that in a different place. Because I don't see anything wrong with that. If people want to do it, you know, if they want to do it, I don't see any problem with it, as long as you have properly done the statutory aspects of the wedding ceremony. You can add to it. Certain things could disqualify it, but most things don't. You know, you could be creative. You could dance a dance. You could stand on your head. You could read poetry.
You know, these aspects intrude into the basic.
Yeah, it has to be very clear, as far as I'm concerned, all of these things are in effect, and this is where we're moving. Perhaps you can see that this is where I'm moving. What you are doing here in the participation in the ceremony is only on one level something that's directly meaningful, let's say. It may or may not be meaningful for the parties concerned. I assume it is. But it derives its meaning from its attachment to the tradition, from it being a part of the way in which a Jewish wedding takes place. You are really attached to that, and you're doing it, and you have to do it in an appropriate and a proper way. Okay? Let's keep going. If so, what does Shmuel then say? If Shmuel really is just saying, he really means Li, and he doesn't say Li, so what did he say? Why did he say Li? That's an obvious question you're going to ask. So then the Gemara answers that he's really teaching a novelty. It's usually what the Gemara will think. If the formulation is slightly different, it's not necessarily to say that you shouldn't say Li, but he's teaching us something else as well. Hane, Lishna Batrahe Kamashmalan. He really is interested in the last expressions of Kiddushin or divorce. It's the other things. He was really trying, it's not the Hare Atna Kudesha Li. That we know. But it was the other things. He was just trying to show us that you can have a variety of formulations. It wasn't the Li part of it, but it was the other things that were important. He just left it out. He wanted to emphasize that these other words could also be used. All right, now here the Gemara gets to the basic thing. Hachakati. Here, when talking about marriage, it is written in the Torah, Ki yikach, when he will take, v'lo sheyikach et atzmo, not that he shall take himself. There has to be an object of the verb. This is not an intransitive verb, ki yikach. He cannot say, I am taken to be your husband. All of those statements where he said, he gave, but he said about himself, that's not permissible. Because the Torah says, ki yikach, v'lo sheyikach et atzmo, not that he shall take himself. Right? He cannot be the object of the taking, of the changing. He must say it in a way that fits the form of the Torah, that he must take her. There must be an object to that verb.
And he is right? The form of another person.
Vishilcha, and he sent her from his house. Veloshiya shalach etatzmo. Not that he shall send himself from her house. Uyishalach. He shall send her. Therefore, the bottom line here is that the formulation is a formulation which is dependent upon the language of the Torah. And the whole structure of things, therefore, is as if, frankly, in my mind, I see these things as along the lines of Bach. Bach. This is like a Bach fugue, a theme and variation. Right? A good Bach fugue starts up. Bum 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 Right, human variation. In the development of Jewish law, I see it as a form of art. And the art here is an art that is akin to music, where you have the scene is a verse in the Torah. It depends upon the way, in fact, the verse is understood. It is understood here as being an active participant. There's a transitive verb. There is a recipient of the action. Ki yikach ish isha. That's how it is. And therefore, as the law grows, as the law develops, as there is language that comes to embody it, it follows the scene. It is not contrary to the scene. And therefore, the issue here really is an issue of attachment to scriptural language and of a literary tradition and a legal tradition and a tradition that goes back to the formulations, as we saw in our first class, of the way in which the Torah itself for the first time broaches and speaks of marriage in the formulations which are indeed in many contexts those of acquisition. But the historical reference are, yes, acquisition, but they're people. They're Adam and Eve. They are Rebecca. And they are Leah. And they are Rachel. And they are all these people, because this is the theme. This is the statement of the theme. This is not just a variation. This is the statement of a basic theme. When marriage itself is articulated, ki kachi shisha. And the experience then of participating is an experience of being part of and a player in a great concert. You want to change it? Well, you could do that, but it's a different concert. It's a different piece of music. This is the music of the halakha. Is the music of the halakha. And this is how the halakha develops itself. And I think it has to be seen in terms of the accretion of language. Language that goes both legally, there's a legal dimension, which is very central to the Talmudic discussions here, and it also has an agadic dimension to it, a dimension that of law, but of lore, of meaning, that goes well beyond legal structures. But the legal structures are, no doubt, central to the way in which the law grows and manifests itself as an embodiment of the original sin. Okay? Questions or contact later.
The rabbis, in these discussions, are they thinking they're making a law or trying to establish ritual for the time in which they lived, or are they imagining that they are deciphering what took place in four times when the Torah says, so for example, when Yitzchak and Rivka became married, that he actually gave her something of value and pronounced these words? Or they say, we don't really know what happened, but we are at least trying to create something that we can say, here's how we are going to do it. How are they thinking about it?
All of the above.
All
of the above are possible. And the way in which people relate to the law and the study of the law reflects a variety of different ways that they, conclusions to which they can come as a result of the good question that you ask. I mean, to some, it's obvious that the only answer that is a religiously acceptable answer is an answer that is, it always was exactly the way it is today. Because if you say that it wasn't exactly the way it is today, then you have taken away the heart of the religious experience. It must always be the same. If you talk to somebody like yours truly, I don't understand that at all. I don't see why that is the only way for something to be both important, central and beautiful and essential. You can, however, go in, you can go much farther than that. You can say that in essence there is no relation whatsoever between the Torah and what we do. That is also a possibility in trying to answer the good question that you asked. I just want to bring to your attention, and we'll maybe share a little bit of this with you now. Not the only really scholarly work on this subject is a book published by the Princeton University Press by Michael Sattler, who's a professor at Indiana University, on Jewish marriage in antiquity. This is a modern scholarly approach to the material that we are reading. And it's a very interesting approach. I agree with probably 50% of what he says. But that's not bad. 50% is pretty good sometimes. The approach is fascinating because one of the things that you can conclude, which is Sattler's, and it's a very accepted view of the history of religion, is that essentially the Jews were probably doing, if not exactly the same thing, then probably nearly the same thing as the Greeks. Why? In terms of marriage. Because, first of all, they were living in a Hellenistic world. What proof do you have that they did anything different? Oh, you have the proof of this Talmud that we're reading. Oh, that's when they decided that they had to do something different, which was a later time of development. Okay? The very fact that we have no earlier sources than the Talmud that are telling us these things in a very clear and explicit way proves, if you need proof, that in fact there really wasn't any of this before, and this is manufacturing. This is a manufactured thing. If it weren't manufactured, we would have earlier proof. We would have earlier proof. Of course, the argument against that is that right? What kind of earlier proof do you think you should have had? Right, so we have a certain amount of proof in the Bible, certain amount of proof. We don't have a lot. You and I just read all the biblical sources for these three forms of Kedushin. I think we all of us, when we read that, said, it's not bad. Proof is pretty good. Pretty good. That it's absolutely clear. Frankly, I could have said it better if it were absolutely clear. You could have said there are three ways, you know, the Bible could have said there are three ways that a man can make kedushin. Kesef, shtar, and beer. That's pretty clear. Why did it have to wait for the Talmud? 1,300 years later, at least. Right? So, these are open arguments. These are way different ways of looking at things. In this book, I'll give you an example. Last time we discussed, and I made reference to it earlier today, that the rabbinic term for kiddushin is kiddushin, as opposed to erusin, which was the biblical phrase. So, we have said before that kiddushin, first of all, introduces a dimension of holiness. Lekadesh is holy. And we also said, as we spoke about last time, where that lekadesh, hekdesh, we saw this in the Talmud, hekdesh means setting aside. That it is something that's set aside to the holy. Excuse me. Here, the rabbinic use of a new term, kiddushin, for betrothal in place of the biblical root haras, might reflect an awareness that rabbinical betrothal is not entirely continuous to its biblical predecessor. In other words, a new word shows that we have a new institution. Okay? Although the biblical term for betrothal is erusin, the rabbis frequently but not exclusively use the term kiddushin. The use of kiddushin as a synonym for betrothal might date to the first century CE, as it is found in the Mishnaic account, he gives the schools of Hillel and Shammai. the relatively late redactor of the first sugya in the Babylonian Talmud tractate Kiddushin. That's what we read. That was the first Mishnah and what followed it. Already did not understand the origin and etymology of the term, explaining it as, quote, he forbids her to everyone as hekdesh. Hekdesh means something that is set aside for the temple. And that's what the Talmud says. That's what we read. Okay? Hekdesh is a technical term that means dedicated to the temple. From the moment that an object is dedicated, even before it is delivered to the temple, it cannot be used. While it is not impossible, the Talmudic etymology of Kiddushin is unlikely. That is standard scholarly approach. Very likely of what the Talmud says is not true. Right? The root Kadash, Kudalachin, widely used in the Bible, does mean to set aside, sanctify, but is used exclusively to refer to things set aside for God as holy, or having some connection to those sanctified things. The sanctified thing is never set aside solely for human use. For a woman or thing to be hektesh, for another human being would be a unique use of the term. And he goes on to say, how therefore, it couldn't be the right term. The Talmud must have been wrong. The Talmud made this up. The Talmud made it up. So, my reading, my reaction to his argument is, that's ridiculous. In language and in life, one of the richnesses of language and life is that different words mean different things in different circumstances. And any rich culture knows that you have to know the circumstances to know the meaning of the word. And in fact, meanings are borrowed. Right? And especially in religion, we have many meanings borrowed from the world around us. When, for example, the Torah says, God said, let there be light, does it mean exactly the same thing as turning on the lights in this room? How could it? I mean, it's a different world. We're borrowing language from everyday experience and using it to talk about things that are not part of everyday experience. So in the language of Kiddushin, the Talmud makes perfect sense. It borrows something that is used in other circumstances, and it doesn't mean that it has exactly the same meaning. If there are 10 meanings to a word, or 10 valences, so it borrows 6 of them and not 10 of them. That means that you can date it as being late? Ridiculous. This is scholarship. Reminds me why I have some problems with scholarship. This is scholarship. This will get you a professorship. Right? The rest, my argument is Bubba Mises. You know, this is what rabbis say and not scholars. Right? All right, he's going to go further, which is cool. Watch this. The rabbinic use of the term kiddushin as a synonym for betrothal might instead have originated as a foreign loan word. The word might have been derived from the Greek term ekdosis, one of the standard terms for the handing over of the bride by her father to her husband. Ekdosis has a k and a d in it. As in what?
Kadosh.
Kadosh, all right? Kadosh. All right? Samech, what do you want? Sin, shin, it's all the same. Okay? One can imagine the attractiveness of such an assimilation. The rabbis, or their immediate precursors, would have read the root of the Greek word as kadosh, ekdosis. They would have seen kadosh in it. A known Hebrew root. The kadesh then would become the Hebrew verb meaning to cause an ekdosis. Right? Ekdosis, as he explains elsewhere in this book, ekdosis means the final piece of the marriage ceremony. So this is standard scholarly approach, which realize what's behind this. Behind this is the assumption that, in fact, what we are reading is essentially Greek. The problem was the rabbis didn't understand the Greek customs well enough, and they brought their own overlay onto the Greek. Okay? Now, if that were true, it would be very interesting. But I can assure you, you can be a very great scholar and say that. Now, I just wanted to show you that there are a variety of approaches to your question. Right? And they are, I think, intellectually satisfying. They're very interesting. They are somewhat mutually exclusive. I don't think that one can have all of those approaches and maintain them with equal conviction. And that leads to interesting religious issues.
Okay. We have in the Torah a number of marriages, and yet the formulation doesn't seem to fall on that experience. And I find that of interest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no gainsaying it. That's absolutely true.
And because, I mean, the richness of the Torah is filled with a bunch of laws, but it's also filled with a lot of people's lives who provide alternative or supplementary or complementary ways of interpreting. But here we ignore all of that. Is there an obvious explanation for that?
I will simply rest my case. Remember Bach. To be continued. Oh, yes, we have a great opening Sunday night.
Thank you.
Bobby's opening and the Roy's opening. Sunday night.
On
the Yiddish Theater.
Very entertaining.
Yiddish Theater.
That's very nice.
That's great.